help the people close to me. They help the people close to them and they hope. Welcome to another podcast, Unguarded Podcast. We're here with Sandrine Zuku, coming to us with some new gems. As y'all know, this is the season where we're talking to athletes that have transitioned, but also entrepreneurs that still, in a sense, work in the sports space or service athletes. Again, trying to keep it as unguarded as possible, as authentic as possible, so we walk away with some tangible advice, not just general advice. So, Sandrine, I appreciate you taking the time. It took us a couple tries because, you know, with me and email, I was close to being like, hey, I need the number because the way life is kind of going right now, it's easier for me to just try to figure this out from the number, but I'm sure you're busy as well. But thank you for taking the time and being on the show with me.
100%. I'm so happy to be here and so happy to be talking to fellow athletes who are really making moves.
Definitely, definitely. So we're going to jump right into, as we discuss the moment where you knew you were officially going to transition. It's a tough time period kind of to identify, but as I've told past guests for this segment, this is the part I'm in technically right now where I am playing, but I am trying to get my LinkedIn right, my resume right, doing Weevolve and finding the right time to exit comfortably where I'm not too much off balance and, you know, the stressors of no longer playing hit me like a whirlwind. So it's like that time period for you. Can you remember where you were and what that felt like?
Yeah, I would say that I actually technically retired twice. And so my first time when I was playing overseas, I was playing in Spain as well as in Lithuania. To be very honest, I at the time had started my MBA and I was taking classes online. I'm originally from Cameroon and I have a very strong Cameroonian mother who was very adamant that basketball was not a real job. And so, to be very honest, the pressure, the conversations about you need to go back and finish school up, you need to make sure that you're, you know, transitioning into your real career, those conversations were honestly just a bit too much. And so I knew that for the sake of just peace, I decided, you know what, let me just transition, let these things go. Although I did want to play at least an additional year, but I decided, hey, let me just get back to school and really just move forward with my life. And so I stopped playing. This was in 2013. Mm-hmm. And then I started my career, I went into finance, and I was about, I want to say a year and a half in, and I had the great fortune of being called back to the national team of Cameroon to play in the Olympic qualifiers that were happening in 2015. And normally at that point, I hadn't played for about a year and a half. I certainly was in no shape to be playing at that point. But I had ultimately decided that I wanted to consider playing because it was the first time that it was being hosted in Yaoundé, which is the capital of Cameroon, and I had never played in front of my extended family. And so I really wanted to take advantage of that opportunity. So I, you know, reluctantly just got back into shape and decided to try out for the team and ended up making it. So I already knew going into those Olympic qualifying trials that I wasn't going to play once I was done because I had taken a leave of absence from work for about 3 months. And so it was, I guess, my second retirement, but it was a nice kind of closing of that chapter. But a really interesting time. And it can be quite jarring, Shirley, as you know, in terms of figuring out who you are and what your identity is beyond basketball.
Would you say, due to having that very smart Cameroonian mother of yours to push you into that transition quicker, would you say her presence really guided you where if she hadn't maybe applied that pressure, you would have played more and more years and kind of put school and really getting your MBA, et cetera, putting that on the side?
No, because I would have done both, to be honest. Mm-hmm. I still wanted to play. And for me, basketball has always been a vehicle to have other experiences. And so I wanted to live in other countries. I'm very nomadic and I move around quite a bit. And so I wanted to use that as an easy way for me to be able to move easily, have a job. Also, obviously, just the benefits of being able to play overseas as well, just having your housing taken care of. And then also having a built-in set of friends that where you don't have to, go out and find every single kind of new community member for yourself. And so it was really a great way for me to explore new places. And so I honestly would have played likely another year or two before really getting back into things. But the nice thing about playing overseas is like you have free time most of the time. You have, quite a bit of free time as well. And so I wanted to use that opportunity to continue taking classes online that would transfer back over into my MBA. So I honestly could have done both, but
life
goes how it goes.
Definitely. A lot of players are balancing both. We see more and more, especially the European players. How was that during the time? Because some say, we don't have time, but we kind of do have time. It's not easy. It's not like it's just I have this immense amount of time and I can just chill to do school and basketball. You do have to kind of balance both. For you during that time frame of studying and playing, how was that experience for yourself? Was it stressful? Do you feel like it is something more and more players? Of course, it is something more and more players should do. Mm-hmm. But how did you go about managing that during the time when you were balancing both?
Yeah, I was really fortunate that I had never really taken a break from school. So the habit of studying, which I think is the trickiest part to get back into if you do take a break, the habit of studying had pretty much stayed consistent, which was really nice. And I only took as many classes as I felt that I could legitimately handle. And so the normal coursework, I did not take the 5 or 6 classes a semester that I normally would have. I want to say during my time overseas, I took maybe 4 classes total, maybe a couple per semester, just given, a little bit of what we were talking about earlier with the two-a-days and the travel, and also you need to rest and you need to live your life and make sure that you're being social and all of those things. And so I did lessen the load, which honestly, it helped me a lot. Just trial and error, I would say. A lot of trial and error.
Yeah, I mean, definitely seems like you made some good steps. And we still try to touch upon the emotional side of the detachment from the sport, even though, of course, you were on your way to bigger and better things. How was the emotional side of knowing that it was over, knowing that you wouldn't be in those locker rooms anymore, or having that community of players easily accessible to you on, a daily basis? How has that been for you since the time of retiring and now being fully immersed in the business side of sport, business, culture, tech, and everything else we'll get into that you're involved in?
Yeah, I felt so many different emotions. I would say the first thing that I felt is a little bit untethered, because what I didn't realize is how much I relied on basketball specifically to organize my life. It was basketball at the center. And of course you have school in college and things and playing overseas, but really basketball was what drove everything else. It paid me and paid for my school. It provided me with my stipends. It provided me with my friends and who became family. And so having to figure out all of those things on my own for like essentially the first time in my life, which sounds ridiculous because at that point you're, you know, I was 23, I believe. And so it was, right. it was very alarming. It was alarming, but in a great way. I think that there was a lot of excitement about what was to happen. I think that transition period, when people are specifically moving from school into like the real world, it's scary. Like, I think you can't get over the fact that it's scary. But more than anything, I would say the community and my friends and like the built-in family that you have is what left me feeling most uncomfortable, because you don't have that, that cushion, that support in the same way. You can't rely on seeing your friends even every single day. You have to go out of your way to even do those things, to set up time to see your friends and do all those things, which is, I mean, it really sounds crazy to me now that I'm thinking back on it, because those are such foundational level skills in relationship building and or maintaining relationships, I should say. But those are a lot of the things that you just basically have to learn all over. But I would say, you know, just an expansive time, but not a smooth one.
Right. Definitely. So you transitioned, obviously well-educated UNLV graduate. So you got your degree, played in college, got your MBA, and then you went on to directly start working in the finance space. And tell us a little bit about how it was navigating that area, the corporate spaces, changing. I mean, the sport industry is completely different than corporate spaces, and how their language, the verbiage. Again, I'm sure you learned a lot during your MBA and going through those different classes and getting your education. But just in general, when you go from sport, being an athlete, and now into these corporate spaces with these different type of people, as they say, white collar, et cetera, how do you, especially as a woman of color, how has that transition been, coming from two different spaces and now having to navigate and find success there?
Yeah, the corporate world is completely different. And in an interesting way, my transition was a little bit smoother because, or at least into the corporate and finance world, because I had joined the, you know, finance company that I was in within a specific program that was a rotational program. And it was a group of 14 of us that essentially all individually would go into different departments within the business and then spend 3 to 4 months in each department and rotate. But our team was the 14 of us. And so much like in the same way that you move somewhere and you have a team that's built in, I had that, which was really, really nice. Like, I had a built-in set of friends. I wasn't alone. I knew everyone that was really going through the same thing. And so it was really nice to be able to have that. But something that I'll also say is that I leaned heavily on my experiences in basketball, like being able to, number one, basketball and being an athlete makes you interesting. And I don't think that a lot of people understand. And in my viewpoint, there's so much politics that is required within a corporate or a corporation. And it certainly was a really massive corporation. And so you have to play the game. You have to learn the rules of the game, you have to learn the culture there. And then you have to assimilate it as much as you possibly can and are comfortable with, of course. And so something that really helped me was leaning on my experience as a basketball player in order to help to position myself in that environment, to give people something to remember me by, which was really helpful. And all of those soft skills, like, you know, I was really fortunate to even serve as captain in my time at UNLV. And even the lessons in leadership that I learned in there was really helpful, even in leading my and helping to support my teammates. And so a lot of those transferable skills that I had learned and experienced through basketball was something that I absolutely leverage in order to help me. But I would say the one thing that was likely the biggest mindset shift between basketball or sports in general into the corporate world was understanding that competition doesn't actually exist. Like, and so
that's it. Okay. That's a good one.
Yeah. I think that, you know, we're so ingrained. Everything is about winning or losing when you're playing, mm-hmm. when you're hooping. And to be honest, you start to feel and sense that a little bit, because even within teams, we had not rankings, but performance reviews, and
right.
it was public who would get, you know, the highest performance reviews and things like that. And while all of that is great, I think it's really important as you're entering into your any work that you're doing that you realize that competition really does not exist. Nobody can be you better than you. And every single person has something to offer. And so I think I spent a lot of time, to be honest, focusing a little bit on competition and thinking, okay, well, we're here as a team, but also there's these individual accolades that I'm looking to achieve. And while that's an important because it's a part of the game, it's a part of the culture, I think if I would have leaned that much more into who I am and what I have to offer, then it would have been an easier experience, I think, especially as a Black woman in a very like non-diverse space that is yeah. finance. And so, and especially being young and not going to an Ivy League school, like these are all things that people kind of dock you for mentally when yeah. you first start to enter the space. But, you know, at the end of the day, no one's lived overseas and played and, you know, gotten these experiences that they could never even dream of having. And they have experiences that I can never dream of having. And so really leaning into, I wish I would have leaned more into like who, all the experiences that I had and who,
yeah.
who I was, you know, who I am uniquely.
Yeah. I think I can't recall who actually said the quote, but in a sense, experiences are like the highest level of education mm-hmm. In some ways. And obviously we don't really, I don't know, value or understand how valuable it is that we get to live in these different countries, not just travel. Like we're living there. We're like fully immersed in the culture, learning things. Like, so it's kind of like one of my friends, Brandon McGill, mm-hmm. he played overseas as well, quit, went to Bali. And he said, and he's an entrepreneur. And one thing he told me, he was like, look, due to the fact that I've been in Germany, the UK, I've been in France playing, et cetera, now in Bali, he's like, that makes me so diverse as an entrepreneur because I can take a business idea and know all these different markets from an intimate level where it can fit. And not many people have that opportunity because they have not, even if they went to Germany and started mm-hmm. doing research, they wouldn't be immersed in a culture like we are able to as athletes because we're put into something that's passionate. You know, you're meeting fans that actually will converse with you on sometimes a very authentic level, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So that is true that we do need to really leverage as the overseas athlete, or I guess I'll, you know, more so say just the global athletes. That's what differentiates us between maybe those athletes that only stay home and get to stay in the major leagues. But we do have an advantage on the back end, which mm-hmm. is experience. And definitely understand like the coming in as a team, and made me think of the Nike Win program that they've been yeah. doing for players, that they're coming in and a lot of them know each other. So they're going into this corporate space. But they're still being able to see players they've played against and yeah. they've either been teammates with. So those types of things being created, I think, are pretty cool. The other thing I was going to touch upon is the accolades. You're right. I mean, right now I've been contemplating, you know, I have the opportunity from Bocconi to get my MBA. Mm-hmm. A little nervous about the GMAT though.
You'll be so fine.
I have my two GMAT books right here. Like, all right, yeah. Let me get to studying again, find time. Yeah. But playing the game, you know, it's been in the back of my head. Okay, what things can they hit me for? You know, like mm-hmm. the next thing is like, you got to get that MBA, right? Mm-hmm. But still understanding that the things I've done, where I've been, where I've lived in the network, are mm-hmm. valuable. So that's pretty cool. Let's jump into Africa, the continent, investments, everything you're involved in. I don't even know. I can't keep up. I'm like, man, Sandrine is so dope. Like, she's doing everything. It's like fashion, you know, investments, still in sport, on the board of Afro Ballers. I don't even know where to start, but I do want, since, you know, we are basketball, I do want to just quickly talk about the growth of basketball in Africa, mm-hmm. you know, the BAL in general. What are you seeing? What are you learning when it pertains to the growth of the sport in the continent right now? Mm-hmm. And what key things, as you've gotten into investment space in sport, I know it's been some time that you've been transitioned. It's not like it happened yesterday, but mm-hmm. what have been some eye-opening things that you were like, oh, this is how it's working compared to when you were on the other side as the talent? Mm-hmm. If you can touch upon those two elements.
Yeah, I would say, so basketball is such a rising sport across the African continent right now. And that's due to the work, like this is due to a couple of decades of work of Amadou Fall, who's now the president of the Basketball Africa League, but, you know, was the CEO of NBA Africa, and the entire ecosystem that has helped to birth the, you know, Joel Embiids of the world and the Pascal Siakams of the world. Because the biggest issue, and this is not just specific to basketball, it's specific to all sports, is that there just simply are not enough places to play. And so the way that you see basketball courts and tracks and, you know, soccer fields like we do in the States just doesn't exist here. And so kids are playing with, you know, playing soccer on dirt patches. And basketball, I mean, wasn't a popular sport because it requires more. It requires a hoop. It requires an actual court where you can see some sort of lines. It requires a basketball. So you have all of those limitations. And so it's taken some time. It's taken some time. But with the dedication of people like Amadou and others, it's been really exciting to see it grow, not only from the playing side, which has been very intentional through NBA, through Basketball Without Borders, through Masai Ujiri's, you know, Giants of Africa as well, and a number of other really important grassroots programs. You've seen so many more young people pick up basketball, which is really exciting. But also, you know, obviously from the business side as well. So you have the NBA that came on board. And I don't think that enough people truly appreciate what the Basketball Africa League is, and how significant and complex of a business it is, because you have a continent that has 54 countries. Even within those countries, you have different languages that are being spoken. These are all different regulatory environments. And so hands down, the Basketball Africa League is the most complex investment that the NBA has and will ever have. And they're trying to, you know, they're really trying to grow the game and really leveraging the NBA's lifestyle brand in order to help to introduce basketball as this sport that not only can help to you know, have your kids run around and keep them healthy, but also making sure that people understand there's economic opportunities behind this game. And so it's been really interesting to see. We're coming up on season 4, which will kick off season 4 of the Basketball Africa League, which will kick off in Pretoria in South Africa here in the next like 3 weeks or so, which is really exciting. So the entity is growing. But, you know, there's still so many gaps across the sports industry as a whole. But there's a lot of excitement around how to do things differently, how to think differently and creatively, and also how to make sure that you're including the opinions, the work of local African people who have been building the game across the continent for decades now. And I think that this movement has really also been ushered in by the likes of Joel Embiid, the likes of Giannis and Pascal and others who have really led the way. And Chinua Ogumike and, well, the Ogumike sisters just in general as well, who are really helping to uplift and create visibility for Africans in the space, and not necessarily even just, hey, there's Africans who are playing basketball, but there's Africans who are playing basketball at the highest possible level, who are MVP of the league. Like, yeah. And so people now have to, it's almost like the rest of the world has been forced to pay attention and to say, wow, like there's this incredible community. There's this incredible potential that really exists across the continent. So it's really exciting to see. It's an exciting, exciting time. There's a lot of things that need to happen, but it's an exciting time for sure.
One player I met who's playing in San Sebastian, her name is Dulcie. She actually is Cameroonian, and she has a finance background. And one thing, you know, I told her, this was, we were trying to reschedule the podcast back then. But it was just how players that are actually from, you know, different countries, but don't have the big, big names like Ogumike. And it's like, okay, how can those players give back now that finally people are paying attention and looking into the continent and going to different countries? From your standpoint, what would be your advice to those types of players that, you know, from Wevolve side that we're meeting that are like, yeah, I actually grew up, I've been born and raised in this country, in these countries or these areas of Africa, and I'm educated, I've had experience playing outside of my country, and whether it be business or, of course, playing, what are some ways that they can be proactive in being a part in the growth of the game?
Yeah. I would say two things. So the two things that are most prohibitive to the growth of the game right now are a little bit like I mentioned, infrastructure. So people need places to play and people need balls. And what I would say, and I'll say equipment also just in general. And when I say equipment, I specifically even want to talk about young girls, especially because a lot of people don't realize that a lot of the reasons why young girls don't play sports across the continent is because they don't have enough hygiene products for themselves for when they start to menstruate. And so they won't play. And oftentimes a lot of them will actually stop even going to school because they have to end up missing so much school because they simply just don't have what it is that they need. And then the second thing that a lot of people don't think about as well are sports bras for young girls as well. And so those are things that I would say that I would include in the equipment bucket along with balls, of course. And so being able to help create courts is something that I don't think people understand how revolutionary that can be for communities, not only providing spaces to have, you know, young people play, but also what tends to happen is that neighborhoods become safer. generally when you have more spaces for play, because a lot of people convene around those areas. And then also they're almost like little economies become formed, because then you have people who are coming and selling snacks or selling drinks and things like that. And so those are really small ways, like micro ways that that can really, really benefit a community. And help to grow the game, which ultimately it's about growing the interest in the game. Like, you can't, it's great to see Giannis on TV, you know, at All-Star, but ultimately if you don't have a place to pick up a basketball and go shoot, then it's just not going to translate. And then the second thing that I would say is I've seen a lot of athletes have more of a focus on youth development and skills building, as it pertains to, you know, running camps. And while I think that that is always needed, I think that there should be an intentional shift specifically for athletes who want to contribute to coaches' clinics. So a huge hindrance in the industry is that you don't have enough coaches who are here on the ground, who quite honestly just have enough knowledge about the game, have had the ability to be trained themselves by really excellent coaches and people who have played. And so I would really encourage athletes who want to get involved and who want to contribute to host coaches clinics almost more than they would youth clinics than anything. Because we need a lot of help in that area. That's across the board, across all sports. And as soon as we start to see, I think, the IQ really rise in that respect, I think we'll see a lot of changes amongst the entire ecosystem. Because ultimately, also, athletes come to the continent and they host the event and then they leave. And then there's no programming left behind. It's hard to, and that's not no fault to them. It's hard to maintain programming, all of that. And so the people who are, you know, here on the ground every day spending time with these kids are these coaches. And so as much as we can pour into them, I think though that's where we're really going to see these investments really compound.
Yeah, no, I think, first of all, the equipment part, that's something that, yeah, just naive and unaware of the realities of what's needed. Mm-hmm. And again, I think courts finding ways to be strategic as a collective. So if there's 10 women from, let's say, Mali, I played with one player that was from Mali. She was a beast. She was a killer. I mean, she was so good. Shout out to Maya. But there's a few players, I think, that have been able to make it to First League Spain, for example. Maybe there's just ways to get with the right people and structure a foundation or something that, all right, now these things can be done as a collective of women to get the funds to do something. But yeah. That definitely makes sense as far as infrastructure, equipment, starting very small. I have a friend, Innocent, who created Hoop Genesis. He's out of Rwanda. Mm-hmm. And for one of the camps, he wants to have me come too. I haven't made my way there yet. Mm-hmm. But yeah, one of the simple things, he was like, we just need balls. He's like, that's one simple thing, a sponsor for balls, nothing crazy. Just basic things, that's where we are right now. So definitely makes sense. However, I agree, and I say it all the time, when the IQ part connects with that talent, I'm like, man, shoot, I make fun. I'm like, the American bloodline, we're out of here. we are no match. Because it's a different type of athleticism, a different type of strength that when you play against someone from Africa, no matter which country in Africa, you're like, yep, they different. So there's a lot of talent there. And I mean, it's going to be exciting. One thing I wrote you before the podcast was to talk about the extraction of that talent. Mm-hmm. to European countries, which mm-hmm. is, I guess, kind of a mix, because if there's no infrastructure, at least the talent that's being extracted at an early age is getting an opportunity. Of course. But we know there's probably 1% that make it through that opportunity, and then the other 99% that don't make it. And during that time of many of these academies or these structures that are created in the European countries, they aren't being educated. They're not still mm-hmm. going to school. They're not being taken care of for their development and their skills as an actual human being. I'm not sure how much you're aware of that, like, structure, especially when it pertains to Italy, Spain, a couple other countries, but touch upon if there's anything being done, or are individuals aware of this dynamic and how that can be shifted as well?
Yeah, I think we're going to continue to see the, you know, the extraction of talent happen naturally. You know, it's the only continent in the world that is getting younger. And so it's, and we just, as it stands, you know, so much of the majority of the value and the talent that is in the sports industry is African or descendants of Africans. And so it's really important and to know that we're going to continue to see it. So that's not necessarily a bad thing. To your point, it's about, at least for me, it's about what is it that we can control? People are, the continent has a history of extraction, not for the benefit of Africans or, you know, Africa or African people. And ultimately, I think we have to control the things that we have to control, which means that there is, you know, ignorance that we truly have about how to make sure that we're protecting our talent, how to make sure that they themselves understand what it is that they are also worth. And for us to be able to, and by us, that not only includes people within the basketball ecosystem, but that can include people who are also creating regulation, so government officials as well, to help to support the facilitation of this movement of talent in ways in which we can protect our athletes and protect them as people, because it's true that far too often you'll see people be, you know, kind of shipped off to a different country, and either they're signing contracts where they're pretty much kind of signing their lives away. And it's not even for that much money, but because it is more money than they would receive mm-hmm. back home, they're comfortable and okay with it, but they're really being taken advantage of. There's initiatives that are intentionally doing that work and trying to educate. And I'm not quite sure how we get this information across to more people on a broader scale. But it is a conversation that needs to happen. And this is actually, this is now kind of giving me a bit of an idea, because we have the All Africa Games, which is essentially like Africa's Olympics, that are coming mm-hmm. up in the next 3 weeks. I believe it starts March 9th. And it's happening in Ghana. And I had the fortune of being able to play in it in 2011. And it's interesting because I always find that that's a convening of the continent's best athletes all in one place. And so I wonder if there's an opportunity to leverage those spaces to be able to help to educate people on, hey, this is the way that things should actually work. You know, I know that there's a lot of legal services that are also trying to provide support to athletes as well. Because at the end of the day, you know, there's nothing like having a lawyer have your back who can understand the documents, understand the process, and who can help to protect you. So we're seeing a lot of work also being done and a lot of conversation being had within the legal space as this industry is developing that can help to protect athletes. So it's a process, and the ecosystem is a scrappy one, that's for sure. So people are figuring it out as we go, but it's a massive right. problem. And I would say that it happens in soccer right now more than any, just because that's, you know, the most significant opportunity. But, you know, it is a problem specifically in men's basketball as we're seeing right now with a lot of people being taken advantage of, for sure.
Yeah. Well, hopefully we evolve can find our way to build those digital communities and utilize the contract tool to help players. I know there's the stigma when it pertains to African descent, which would be the African Americans, myself, and then those that actually still have that, you know, African mother like yourself, with, you know, mm-hmm. it's totally different. And me and internally, some of my African teammates from different, you know, I play with from Cameroon, Mali, some Rwanda. They say, you know, Americans, you soft, you know, like you guys complain, you're talking about, you know, we're here getting this money, we're trying to take it back home. And I get that. And I do understand that. And in some cases, I'm like, y'all right, we are kind of spoiled. But what I've learned and what I've seen, especially in Spain, is that, you know, you it's not about if you are better than me and I'm asking for more and you's like, I'm taking this and you're better. Actually, I want you to get what I'm getting, because if I'm getting this and your talent is a little better than mine, then why is it, you know, that it shouldn't be that, oh, look at the Americans, because then we're both losing in my eyes. Yes. Now they know they can go get your talent, which is better than me. That is not something to be proud about.
It's not.
And that's like a concept I've seen, that like, it's like the mind has shifted that, oh, the Americans, they complain, they're not more talented, et cetera. Let's see what happens when we both ask for the same. You still might win, but now you are getting more. When we talk about transparency and understanding and contracts, that's one thing that I've talked about to a few of my teammates, but I know the culture is different than America, in that, you know, respect and, you know, how you move in a certain way and following the right rules. I know, like, from the communities and how the families are built in Africa, and sometimes in some ways it's not the same as in America. And so I see some of the players don't fight back in that way. But I know it is something that I think is an issue, because, you know, especially in the women's side, probably also the male side, I would assume that a lot of players are grossly underpaid. And that's one thing I think needs to change. And, you know, hey, the money you're making might be a lot back home, but hey, make even more, you know, like, why not? Shoot. I mean, so I think, building those communities. And again, Weevolve is not used for global athletes, but our goal is that transparency. Like, let's build the micro community within Weevolve, from those who came from Mali, who came from Cameroon, who came from Nigeria, and be able to tap in and know your truth. The more we can just communicate, I think that leads to growth as well. And helping the talent that is going all over the world to level up and then be able to provide for their families in a bigger way.
Yeah. It's a huge, huge problem. And it's something that I talk about all the time. And I think this is just a huge problem in general amongst women getting paid in general with work, but we have to talk more about what it is that we're making. And we have to also hold each other accountable more, because to your point, you know, it's interesting. I was listening, there's a group of women in the media who were having a conversation. It was like Angela Rye and a couple of other people. And there was one woman in particular who said that she didn't know how much everyone else was making. And she had shared that, I believe it was with Angela Rye. And Angela told her, like, absolutely not. You basically need to double your price, like, because you're dragging the rest of us down. Because if you accept that rate, then they're going to look at my rate like I'm being crazy asking for this much. And so those conversations and that transparency has to 100% happen. And while, you know, I think growing up in the States, I have like one foot in both culture so I can understand how uncomfortable it may be to have those conversations, but at the same time, how necessary it is. But it comes from a place of not knowing your value. It comes from a place of not understanding the business side. And when you don't know how much, you know, the owners are making, when you don't know how much sponsorship dollars are coming in, you're happy with taking, you know, the whatever few thousand dollars that you'll take. But ultimately, when you start to understand, like, no, this is an engine, and there's a significant amount, like the you know, player salaries are a small portion oftentimes, especially for women. I mean, women in the W are still fighting for this, which is just crazy to me. But you know, the player salaries are such a small portion of what the entire entity makes. It's unacceptable. And so these conversations have to happen. It has to change, because we have to ask for more. Women also generally don't do a good job of advocating for ourselves and asking for more and negotiating. And so those are all things that we have to make sure we're doing across the board, because it only helps everyone. And literally everyone. People don't understand, like, when women have more money, the world is a better place, hands down.
Hands down. That's wonderful. I'm gonna have to make sure I put that one on a quote. I know we're on time, but just to wrap it up, I wanted to just talk about, again, players are transitioning, players are becoming, they're more aware of investing. You know, I have another young player. She's from French Guyana. Mm-hmm. So still family somewhere across there. But she was just so hungry about, I want to get into investing. I want to be into that type of space. You know, I want to figure out how can I get into things like BAL. And I was like, whoa, I don't have that background, but I can, you know, we'll figure it out how to get you tied to these people. But I think a lot of athletes are wanting to get into investment, but some of them know they don't know. They want to do it the right way. They want to find internships that are meaningful. As you are in the continent, you're involved in the investment side, you're involved in the different programs that are being built in Africa. Just as a closer, for those athletes that want to be proactive while they're playing, but also start to build and gain experience, what would be your advice to them during these years, especially those, like, she's a rookie, her first year. Mm-hmm. So that's beautiful to hear. How to use, if you say, okay, even I'm going to play 5 years, how could they be using those 5 years, for example, to really be involved in setting themselves up to have a quality resume alongside of their playing career to ultimately transition into a space or a role that's going to, you know, be fruitful, but also they will enjoy.
Yeah. The one thing that I would say that absolutely everyone needs to start doing, regardless of when you feel like you're going to transition out of playing, and I think that you do this really well as well, is LinkedIn. Like, people don't understand how valuable, and it's not necessarily, I should say, LinkedIn, but whatever your presence is on social media, that is the number one biggest investment that you can make in yourself. And I would also say is, you know, just under the personal branding umbrella, is to completely remove any idea of the way in which you have to present yourself online, or, you know, any hesitations that you may have about whatever it is that you want to do. And so what people are going to see you as, whatever you say it is that you are. And so I would say to not be hesitant. If people want to be in media in Africa, then start posting content about that. If you want to be, you know, in fashion, if you want to be in anything, if you want to be an investor, start posting content about some of the deals that are taking place, things that you're naturally interested in, invested in, because people will start to associate those things with your brand and with you. And so you'll come top of mind when people are thinking about things. People are seeing articles or more stories coming out about the various things that you're posting about or that you're sharing. They're going to start to align to you. There is no, and I say LinkedIn specifically because LinkedIn, especially for athletes, is becoming a more friendly place for creators. I literally just yesterday had a conversation with the manager of a community of creators that works for LinkedIn. And he was saying that he's a sports fan. So he was saying that he's been really excited not only to see more people talking about sports, but also specifically they've had a large rise in athlete creators on LinkedIn. And while you're playing is also a great time to position yourself because you still have, quite honestly, like the sexiness of still being an athlete. And so being able to leverage that spotlight that you have on yourself and then using that to be able to talk about the things that you want to talk about, literally whatever they may be, is something that is going to help you secure positions for yourself. You can monetize the platform yourself, which is, you know, just great. People start to share, you know, I've had people share investment deals, people looking for consulting work, all of these things that really just start to come your way. And then you can decide what it is that you want to engage with and that you want to participate in. But the biggest investment that you could possibly make is going to be in yourself. Everything else will, in my viewpoint, will come from that. Just present yourself on social media and like post and post consistently. Yeah. Because to be honest, I started Playbook in Q3 is when I really started like ideating around it. And then Q4 is when I started posting. And even in the span of 3 months, the types of opportunities, the visibility, even just the types of people that I've met, I would have 100% never met them and had them at least even understand who it was that I am and what it is that I want to do if it wasn't for the consistency in posting. It will bring you visibility. So in any case, let me get off my soapbox. I swear.
I wanted, I was going to say, and I wanted you to give the exit of, you know, Playbook. I know the media outlet is really about business, sport, investment, et cetera. But for the athletes that are listening, of course, a few other individuals tune in from time to time, but most of the listeners are athletes. Just to exit with, you know, what Playbook is and a little bit of, you know, again, it's always about how can players get involved if they have the opportunity to get involved or be of support.
Yes, for sure. I think so. Playbook is a sports business media company that is focused on emerging markets because Africa is what I know best. And, you know, we're seeing a lot of opportunity really happen between the Middle East and Africa specifically. We'll be launching in the next few weeks with content surrounding those two regions. We're really excited about the growth of the sports industry. The intention is to have one place where you can find sports business news about the African continent, about the Middle East as well. And the hope is that the Playbook universe grows. And so we'll ultimately have Playbook Latin America and Playbook Southeast Asia, et cetera, talking about emerging sports economies and really in an effort to not only create communities to help to drive the development of these industries, but making sure that we're doing so for the benefit of these geographies themselves, for them to be able to develop the sports industry for the benefit of their talent and for the betterment, you know, of their communities as much as possible. And so we really focus right now on two main pillars. We're obviously in content, aggregating content. We'll be also creating custom content, which is really exciting. And then the second piece is events. And so we'll certainly be looking to host events where we can have these conversations in person and also making sure that we're bringing the community together in, you know, in real life and making sure that we're really more than anything facilitating capital flow, facilitating kind of transfer of resources as much as we possibly can to help further the development of the industry. And I would say, in terms of the ways that athletes specifically can get involved, I think obviously when we personally being an athlete, I think athletes are the center of the sports industry, hands down. And there's a lot of interesting stories that I would love to even personally cover that are specific to athletes and what it is that they're going through, the athlete economies themselves. And so I would love to continue to engage and see who are some people who are really tapping into the business world as well to help to further grow, you know, their exposure in terms of how they're looking to contribute to, and it doesn't necessarily have to be into the sports industry in particular, but how they're leveraging their platforms to continue to grow. So Leeds, we want it to be a platform that is grown organically and grown through the community. So what is it that hearing from athletes on, what is it that they want to know, like, is tremendously, tremendously helpful. And that can, you guys, I'm on LinkedIn. People are more than welcome to DM me on LinkedIn or connect with me, because it's really, really valuable to me to understand what it is that people need help with, what it is that they want to know, because within the community, there's people that have this information. We just have to tease it out. And so I just want to provide as many resources as possible, but we have to figure out what it is that people need and stay on top of that. So I think feedback, that feedback loop is really going to be more than anything, what's really helpful. I'm trying to think, even from an investment perspective, there's going to be more information that we're also going to be sharing as we evolve about like investment opportunities as well.
Yeah.
And so I want to make sure to share those, especially with the athlete community, so that they can participate in the upside, because it's really, really, really important that athletes have ownership in the sports industry. And so I don't know what that's going to look like, maybe a newsletter, maybe a community of some sort. But eventually that's going to be something that we're going to be offering for sure. And that we want to, you know, ensure that athletes are really the core of that community, really getting that information.
Well, we definitely look forward to it. We would love to have Playbook on the Weevolve platform as a community. So we'll have to come back and bug you again, and definitely would also love to have you on the platform so we can connect those players that are from the continent and are looking to be in finance and investment. I think you would be a great person. I know you're busy. So we wouldn't send anybody that's not serious about wanting to grow your way. Yeah. But of course you would be a great asset for us to be able to recommend and send some players your way that really want to find their way into the space. But I do thank you for the time, Sandrine. And I know we went over time, but it's, you know, it took us a little bit to get here. But I do appreciate the gems that you've dropped, a lot of valuable information. And, you know, best of luck as you continue to just do everything with your business, everything for the continent of Africa, which is wonderful. I'm excited.
Thank you.
And yeah, just appreciate the time again.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me. I'm so honored to, you know, be a part of the Weevolve community. And I want to support you guys as much as possible. You guys are doing important work. So I'm here. I'm here to help. You to saving the force when they the record group. I guess I gotta do it on myself.